Welcome to On Air, a podcast discussion at the intersection of artificial intelligence and international relations, where we will discuss the development of IR theory, law, and practice in the age of AI.
Dr. Yelena Tsupach is a postdoctoral research fellow in the Global Governance Research Unit at the WZB Berlin Social Science Center in Germany. Dr. Tsupach has published on topics of global governance, technology, and gender. And today we'll be focusing on Dr. Tsupach's work on patriarchy, democracy, and AI ethics. Dr. Tsupach, we're delighted to have you on air. Welcome to the show. Dobrodošli na On Air.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be on the show as well.
Would you consider yourself a AI optimist or an AI pessimist when it comes to the bigger question of AI ethics and AI's kind of transformative effect on global governance more broadly?
Well, I would definitely situate myself in the middle. I wouldn't say that I am an AI skeptic. I can actually say that I'm very, very excited to be living in a time when we are going through this extreme digital revolution. But I think I'm also acutely aware of all the dangers that it brings. So for me, the question is more whether I'm optimist in terms of whether humans can handle it properly, not the technology itself. And there, I'm beginning to have my doubts now, kind of dealing more and more with the regulation. And we've already mentioned the illiberal backlash that we are seeing globally. I have a sense that this digital revolution, AI revolution, is not happening in a good international context. And that's what's worrying me. And my fear is that if we do not kind of plug some holes at this moment or prevent some things from happening, that it will be too late later on, that we will have this kind of perpetual machine that will cause more harm than good. So it really boils down to my optimism in humans. I do still have it, but I do not see favorable international or even domestic conditions for it.
That's interesting that you started off with the description of like, well, what the technology itself potentially is positive, but what humans do with it might not be, which is interesting because I wonder if the humans who created it have created it in a way that makes it destructive through biases that are reproduced in this technology. I think you've pointed to some of this relates to gender biases or racial biases in a lot of these AI systems in your own work.
Yes. So the work that I did on AI specifically and AI regulation, so I do not deal with AI systems and biases within AI systems and more with regulation that is kind of trying to solve the problem of biases in AI systems. And in that sense, that's where my optimism would lie, because I'm deeply convinced that people who are producing AI systems either don't know anything about how societies work. So we have this acute lack of social scientific knowledge among people who are producing these systems. So I don't think everything is intentionally bad. So there is this intention to kind of have systems that continuously, perpetually discriminate women and different races. I just think that there is not enough social scientific knowledge in among AI developers. And that is something that I would like to see resolved. And the way that can be resolved, I think, based on still very limited research that I've done, is by having a very good regulation. A regulation that actually addresses these issues in such a way that we do not stifle the development of technologies for the good, yet not allow for this technology of the future to actually just import the most conservative elements of our society into our future.
Well, since you're discussing this, I mean, you mentioned prior, right before we started this conversation with Chris, you were discussing how the EU may actually have an impact, right, with regards to some of these illiberal or hybrid democracies, including here the countries in Western Balkans, but beyond that, I mean, there's, you know, democracies have actually, unfortunately, taken a step back over the last decade. So this is a recurrent theme, I think, throughout the world. But the EU has certainly been has taken the lead when it comes to drafting AI ethics frameworks. And you're alluding to that maybe, hopefully, the prospect of EU membership may help these countries to kind of at least protect the citizens of these countries from onerous government oversight. Do you see the EU as actually, or this kind of regulation coming to the EU as possibly having some positive effects in that direction? Are you optimistic about that aspect of it?
Here, I wouldn't say that I have a lot of optimism, because after engaging with the EU AI Act for a bit, I don't see that this act will prevent disruptions to Western democracies, because it doesn't address them adequately, at least in my opinion. And in that sense, if it's not going to prevent harms to EU democracies, I'm afraid it will not have huge effect on the neighboring countries or other countries globally, because the EU wants to be a kind of norms setter in the domain of AI. AI as well. So I wouldn't go so far as to say that I'm fully pessimistic, but I'm very, very, very cautiously optimistic. Because if we read the EU AI Act, if we think about things like social bots and deep fakes and these emotion recognition systems, they are now classed as kind of limited risk technologies. But if we think about these technologies in political context, I think they're really not limited risk technologies. So I think there are a lot of loopholes where more harm than good still can be done.
Yelena, in a co-authored paper published in Ethics and International Affairs, you expressed concern regarding, quote, a broader trend in international politics, the illiberal backlash against the liberal international order, where a diverse constellation of actors positioned within and outside liberal democracies has increasingly challenged the values and norms that have dominated international politics since the end of the Cold War. Can you tell us more about why this is, and what do you mean by illiberal backlash, and how does it manifest itself?
The question of why this is happening is a very difficult question. This is a question that is now being debated in international relations and political sciences more broadly. I specifically deal with one part of that illiberal backlash, and that's anti-gender backlash by various conservative actors. And there I can say a little bit more, and I can actually say what my preferred theory of why it is happening. Because it is termed as backlash, we see it mostly as a kind of reaction to manifold successes that feminist organizations had, specifically after the Cold War. So feminist organizations, by their very cosmopolitan nature, I would say, have been very good in organizing transnationally. And they have recognized very early on that international organizations, specifically the United Nations, are open to contributions from civil society. And that's the kind of opportunity structure that they used. And then we've ended up with concepts such as gender, sexual and reproductive health and rights being enshrined in many of the UN documents after the Cold War. Conservative actors, on the other hand, by their very nature, they are parochial actors. They did not have any kind of strong transnational networks, but they have been very alarmed by what was happening in international organizations. So their sense was that their values are being attacked from this international level. So they said, okay, we have to go there and kind of try to change that, try to fight it. So in the past 10 years, in particular, although we've seen conservative actors engaging with feminists earlier, but in the past 10 years, we have seen this building of a larger coalition. And this larger coalition now includes very diverse states. So we see Muslim states, post-Soviet states, Russia is there, Vatican is there, US under Trump administration. So all of them have kind of these either state groups or kind of state civil society groups where they're really, really trying not just to delete progressive language from the UN documents, and this is across different issue areas. So not only in those documents that specifically target women's rights and gender equality, but across issue areas in the UN. So they're really trying to detect this progressive language. They work very hard on deleting this language, and then they also work very hard on inserting their own preferred values, their pro-family and pro-life, pro-traditional family, I should say, and pro-life values. And this is the dynamic that we now see. We essentially have, my focus is mostly on the UN, but something similar is happening in Europe as well. We see these kind of two groups, feminists and anti-feminists. They're not monoliths, but still there is this polarizing moment that kind of hardens them on both sides, and they're engaged in this various fights over more progressive gender and women's rights norms, and I would say more conservative, if not regressive, understandings.
Yelena, what is unique about the AI issue here? I mean, I'm trying to think about the permutations of this. We were discussing before the show that, you know, similar debates have taken place in the context of international law as well, international criminal law specifically, where attempts at, you know, they say, you know, certain language that was inserted into the text of the treaties was seen as criminalizing, let's say, anti-abortion laws and others. And so you see these conservative countries come in and try to change that. How does that manifest itself in the context of AI ethics and the AI governance frameworks?
Well, my sense so far was that AI governance has been fairly progressive in the language it uses, because the push even from the civil sector and also AI developers in recent years has been, let's not maybe not call it a push, but there was this greater recognition that indeed AI systems can produce biases. And as that's happening, we have this illiberal backlash arising. So these are kind of two things happening at the same time. And it seems that in this particular case that we are discussing in the paper, and that's Poland disputing in 2020, the Council of the European Union, Council's conclusions on the role of AI in European Union or larger European Union a normative context of fundamental rights and so forth. So Poland, as a kind of conservative actor in the EU, is happy to say, yes, we will adopt, we agree that AI can be problematic on the fundamental rights issues, but there is this one thing that we really, really disagree, and that's the notion of gender. So if you include the notion of gender equality in this AI document, which is, by the way, not legally binding document, so it doesn't have the weight.
But it is normative, right? It's norm setting, it is. Which is the concern, exactly. Obviously.
It's not an important document, right, by any means, but still it's not a legally binding document. And they have said, so Poland has said, if gender equality stays in this document, we are just not going to support that document. So there was this willingness to kind of jeopardize the entire normative thinking understanding of AI just because of this one thing that they have strong ideological objection to. And when we were writing this paper, we were thinking, well, this is very kind of odd because it's not something that we have seen recently. Because adopting ethical standards has become kind of, it's a cheap business, at least. That's how it's being, right? Everybody is adopting ethical standards. They're a way of signaling. There are very few people who will say we are against trustworthy, responsible, human-centric AI and so forth. Poland is not ready to say that. So they're not objecting to that part. But nonetheless, they are still ready to kind of say, no, this big document will not be adopted if it includes gender equality as a concept. Because Poland essentially contests the notion of gender as different from the sex.
Right. So if I get this right, then in a way, debates over AI provide an opening for conservative countries and, you know, movements within those countries, or, you know, transnational advocacy movements, to open debates that perhaps they lost a decade ago, right? But this is where the juncture where you have this opportunity now to reopen something that was not available to you. Because these changes obviously may have an impact on your understanding down the road as well. Is that what's happening? So, their concern is not specific to AI or AI ethics, but there's a general societal kind of concern.
I think that's a very nice summary of how we understand this dynamic to be unfolding. That there is, if we speak specifically about Poland, at no point would we be ready to say Poland is against regulating AI from the perspective of, as I said, at least with these notions, a trustworthy AI, human-centric, and so forth. But it, as you said, Medlir, it represents a very or one more opportunity structure where they feel they have to defend their values. I think there is this sense that if the concepts like gender equality are allowed to proliferate in many different areas, then that's it. That's just AI would develop in the context of very progressive values, and I don't think that's what they want to see.
Jelena, of course, one of the fascinating aspects of the political debates and fights over the advancement of gender rights is the fact that, as you put it, these battles are not isolated only in one arena, but take place in the assembly halls of the United Nations and other international organizations, where advances or setbacks in one form have a direct impact on another. How do debates regarding gender and AI compare to similar gender-related issues?
Yes, as I said previously, what we see now is that these kinds of contestations are happening across various issues within international organizations. Where we see it in the UN specifically is on the issues of disability, for instance. And it would be very difficult to say, what does disability have to do with gender rights directly? But it is very interesting to see that even in issues that are not so prominent, that are not prominently debated, these conservative groups, conservative civil sector allied with sympathetic states, believes that it is very important to fight for their values on all fronts. And what we find particularly interesting is that in each of these fronts, very similar tactics are employed. So what we see in disability rights, we see in the regulation of AI. And that makes it a very, very interesting phenomenon, I think. In the text, my co-author, Hendrik Schopmans, and I, we use this term spoiling. And that's a very very common strategy where an entire document is threatened to be vetoed if a particular phrase is not deleted or particular phrase inserted. One prominent case in the UN that we had in 2019 explains or describes this very nicely. So the Security Council of the UN has been since early 2000s has been adopting resolutions in this agenda called Women, Peace and Security. And that has not been a very kind of fraught process. It has had its problems, but because the agenda is very difficult to object to because it relates to sexual violence against women in conflict and so forth, it has not been extremely difficult to get countries to say yes. But in 2019, with Trump administration in office, the ninth resolution of the on this agenda, the Women, Peace and Security, included the phrasing sexual and reproductive health and rights, which, as we already said, is interpreted as a euphemism for abortion. And in an attempt to kind of prevent any possibility of abortion being legalized in an international context, the US said, no, we are going to veto this resolution unless this phrasing is deleted. But what does it tell us is that the US was really ready to strike a resolution about sexual violence against women in conflict based on this one thing. So there is this huge disregard for the a larger issue that is at stake as long as this one thing is there. So what we see with women, peace, and security, we see in disability rights, we see it in same-sex partnerships as well. And then we see it now in the European Union with respect to AI. And that was also partly our fear. We don't make a strong case in the paper that we will definitely see this in other AI regulation and so forth. But we kind of invite researchers to not think about AI in international context only through this AI arms race kind of thinking, but let's think about it also in the context of the illiberal backlash, because it can create some very important disruptions.
So the threat is not only then in terms of, as you pointed out earlier, in terms of just the biases that may be embedded in AI algorithms or whatever, right, that reflect kind of the inadequacies of programming and other things. One of the biggest and more immediate threats perhaps is also what you're pointing to now, which is that in the process of coming up with these draft regulations for AI, we may actually be relitigating debates and discussions that may actually be setting back the women's rights agenda in a way by 5 or 10 years, because we're relitigating, reopening, renegotiating things that we thought that we had agreed to. One of the things that is missing from this whole conversation, our questions and this whole discussion, you know, we've talked about NGOs, we've talked about, you know, illiberal states. I mean, you mentioned Poland is playing this very kind of like a spoiler kind of role within the European Union. And I imagine if you bring in more of the other countries, if you bring in some of the Western Balkan countries, you may have perhaps some other issues in there. There's the role of big business and big tech, right, is not there. We know that they play quite a big role just generally in the setting of these ethics. I know that even when with the GDPR, for example, you know, the EU was kind of walked around very gently and very lightly around these particular issues, make sure not to alienate in a way big tech, while also providing for some regulations. Where do you see big tech, kind of what role do you see them playing here? If any, do you see any evidence of their engagement and pushing or allying with one side or the other?
I would not be able to competently answer this question because I have not engaged with it fully. But I think the question itself, if I might answer with a kind of dilemma almost, so more think about it than have an answer. I think it's very interesting. You are right. Big tech has been instrumental in kind of pushing for a very lean regulation, one that would not prevent them from developing AI and developing it very fast.
And making use of our data in a very, you know, copious manner, right? And so just having access to everything. And so they just kind of free up as much as they can regulation.
Exactly. So in that sense, we can say that they are not very concerned about, so biases are a concern for them, but they still don't want to have too much burden to kind of get rid of these biases. So you know about all the proposals for introducing impact assessments, conformity assessments. And if we read the EU AI Act, it also reads very, okay, this conformity assessment, it will not be very cheap and you will have a standard to just tick some boxes and see if you can do it. So although I think big tech will speak about biases, they are a hindrance or handling biases a hindrance to developing AI very fast. So when they are lobbying for some kind of regulations, I don't think that they will be strongly emphasizing the bias issue. And then they are also under scrutiny because they themselves don't have many women AI developers. So in that sense, they also have a serious, so they are a target and they have a serious problem. So if we just look at all of these aspects, I don't see them as a necessarily positive progressive force in all of this. Yeah, I think that they will still have their codes of conduct, that there will be a lot of ethics washing, but that there a lot of push will still have to come either from very progressive countries that are concerned with these issues and don't really want to yield too much, or civil society. But then we have this problem of civil society effectively being very, very weak. And that's why I think I, in the beginning, I also said that I was optimistic, but very cautiously optimistic in terms of how things will pan out.
One thing that really struck me in what you said earlier is that this framework of viewing AI development through the arms race or through kind of coalitions of countries that are kind of more illiberal in terms of their kind of domestic uses, like digital authoritarian applications of AI versus countries that are kind of that have a different set of values in relation to how AI is used, is not necessarily a helpful way to look at this, in part because what we're seeing here is shifting coalitions where one state or a coalition of states will act as a spoiler to just kind of throw a wrench in the works of global governance more broadly, making kind of broader kind of global governance more challenging and difficult on the basis of these. Like, as you mentioned, like the Poland example is a pretty good illustration of this. Well, it's AI today. It could be another issue area tomorrow, which makes kind of the entire edifice of global governance much more difficult to imagine progressing, especially in the context of many of the challenges that we are faced with today. And I was going to ask about kind of competing poles of kind of other ethical frameworks and competing poles of governance. But I think in this particular context, I just want to stop for a second and think about some of the questions of surveillance, of kind of authoritarian applications of this technology, although it's not quite what we started off talking about. It also does reflect some of the concerns, particularly in kind of in EU enlargement and the Western Balkans. I guess there's a convenient coalition here between states which are both kind of conservative and opposing this, and also states which are more willing and more interested in these technologies for other purposes. In that context, is there really a lot of reason to be optimistic? I mean, this seems to be very, very worrying from my own perspective, right?
Yes, I mean, I think in my answers also to your optimism, pessimism question, I was listing more of the things that could kind of prompt us to think very pessimistically about these developments. But I think it's also a personality trait of mine that I really don't want to be overly pessimistic about it. And there is a kind of a part of me where I, if I think about the next 10 years, I see a kind of storm, right? We will have further development of AI. We will have some attempts to regulate it. We will have many breaches of data, then attempts to have the European data infrastructure, European kind of digital sovereignty thing, and so forth. And when I think about this coming 10, 20 years, I see it as a kind of dynamic process. And let's say there will be work for us as social scientists as well in that process. So the question then becomes, is everything just going to collapse? Or in that process of trying to regulate something, then having breaches and having different very problematic softwares implemented here and there and so forth, what will be the outcome of that? And there I feel that I'm very, very optimistic. Although I envision this storm coming, I also have kind of trust that that we will have, is that an expression, a kind of handle on it at the end. So that's where my optimism comes from. But you are 100% right. I mean, if we put everything on paper with AI arms race, with the illiberal backlash, even with the ongoing invasion of Ukraine, I think these are all the reasons why we shouldn't have a lot of space for optimism. I mean, just if the UN starts thinking about AI in any really focused way, then we have this huge problem with China being there and so forth. So my optimism answer, as I said, it's more kind of a personal trait maybe than an objective analysis of what's in store.
Well, I'm not sure what's objective anymore in a lot of these kind of discussions. As you point out, I think a lot is about obviously personality trait, but also just how we we judge certain pieces of evidence that are in front of us. And that's why this differs. I like to think that that this is almost like a dialectic, right? There's a certain kind of relationship here where there's a back and forth between, you know, the different as poles, as Chris was talking about, where sometimes it, you know, the pendulum swings to the left, another time goes to the right, and then there is always this pushback depending on where you are at a particular particular point. And so I guess the question then before we wrap this up, but you know, I guess my question is what's next? Where do you see this going? Right, this liberal backlash. Do you see this pushing further, or from what you, at least in the European context, have we kind of reached the point where the antithesis has become the thesis, and now that we have another antithesis coming in to produce a new synthesis?
Yeah, I think it's exactly how that kind of dialectic process, that's how I see it at the moment. Before Russian invasion of Ukraine, I think I was, this is again very odd to say, so I was more pessimistic concerning the state of liberal values. So because they were maybe in this state of slightly crumbling or being questioned more than they are maybe now. So in that sense, the invasion, I think, had this effect of solidifying trust in liberal values. The question remains, how long will that hold? Will there be a moment of fatigue and then just things kind of going back? I am very, like, if I think about the broader picture, then there it becomes, yeah, maybe Europe will have less problems with illiberal backlash, at least in the short term. But if we think about the Balkans, for instance, there I have very little optimism that anything will change for the better. If I think about China, I don't think things will change for the better. So now the question becomes whether we are just in this brief period where we've rediscovered liberal values and kind of gathered around them, and then it will just fizzle out, or if it will materialize in the opposite of it. Again, it's very difficult to speculate. I have, again, this personal optimism, but there are many arrows pointing into a very negative development. And I wouldn't like to speculate any further about it. Yeah.
So maybe, you know, cloudy with a chance of rain, I think was perhaps, the weather forecast. So here's then the last question for you, and that has to do with your research agenda. So what's next? There's a certain sense of synergy between your research, right? What you have published so far. What's next in terms of your research agenda with regards to AI, but other areas as well?
Yeah, in the next couple of years, my research will be focused on particularly on these two issues. It's international governance of AI and contestation of women's rights in international organizations. And I will track carefully whether we see further overlaps here, such as in the case of Poland. I have been looking now at the EU AI Act, and I see that there is only one mention of gender equality in this big act that has 100 and some pages. So the plan is to track these developments separately, to examine moments when they might overlap, and our prediction is that they will overlap. But I will also stay studying these two things kind of separately, because as I said before, I think there is a kind of storm coming in the coming years, and it will be very interesting to see how it all plays out. In terms of anti-gender backlash, the big question is, so while Trump was in office, these groups had a huge opportunity structure to do a lot of things in the UN. Once that opportunity structure closed, we didn't see a lot of retrieval, right? We still see these groups pushing forward. So that is very interesting. I think they're a staple of the UN at the moment, and we should track it. We should track how they actually change our perception of international organizations. On the level of AI and AI regulation, what I'm very, very interested at the moment is how the UAI Act, if it ever gets to be adopted, which I expect will be in the next couple of years, how will this risk structure be translated into actual regulation of actual AI systems? And there I have been dealing a little bit with those standardization bodies, looking at them. And that's a very interesting story, because these standardization bodies, they're used to dealing with very technical issues, technical properties of some hardware machines, or maybe the shape of fruit, as a famous example of EU sees it. But now, because this EU AI Act treats AI as a product, and as a product that can be standardized in much the same way a toy can be standardized, it will probably go to the standardization entities, which are private entities. And I'm very, very curious to see how are they going to handle fundamental rights. How does one standardize fundamental rights for an AI company to just follow this checklist?
Well, thank you so much, Yelena. And as always, if you like the show, we invite you to subscribe and leave us a comment. You can follow us on Twitter at @onair_podcast. And don't forget to join us for the next episode for a discussion at the intersection of AI and IR theory, law, and practice. Until then, stay human.